You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, a paramedic bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. We're here.
Welcome.
We're back again.
It's like we're just not going to go away.
No, we're like clockwork. Every week, we're here waiting for you with another scintillating topic of EMT-ness.
We know that every week you're sitting there like, what are they going to cover this week?
It turns out it's probably whatever's on the NREMT curriculum.
Yes.
Usually in the order of which they present it.
Yes.
Well, this week, we're talking about drugs.
Hey, we're getting to the good stuff, people.
Yeah. Now we're getting after it, you know?
We can finally start doing some damage.
I don't like the drugs, but the drugs like me. Actually, I messed up the name of the title. The title of the episode is I don't try the drugs, but the drugs try me.
Which is what they do.
Yeah, it's tough. This has been like, it's a lot of stuff to learn.
Yeah. This was, for me, not as deep a dive as like the physiological stuff, but still, like, there is a lot. There was so much information in this particular one to break down and try and assimilate and try and absorb.
Well, this was book learning stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, hey, we gotta sit here. We gotta learn names. Mm-hmm. We gotta figure out, like, you know, not only just one name, multiple names for certain drugs, mm-hmm. and what they do, and then understanding how those drugs actually relate to anatomy and physiology. There's a reason why they do it in the order that they do.
It definitely seems like there's some kind of like roadmap and methodology they're using, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wait till you guys go to paramedic school and you got to learn like 40 different drugs.
Whoa.
Not going to have to pump the brakes there.
No.
Paramedic school is probably not as far off as I hope it is. Because I'm really enjoying this. Like,
800 hours.
I know. But like, this is my only hesitation. I've just started riding on an ambulance. Like, I know nothing. I'm at that point where I'm like, I know absolutely zero, like in terms of practical application, but I really like it. Like, I want to do this more. And the paramedic thing, it's just like this, just doing this 144 hours has like usurped my life.
Yes.
Especially adding the podcast onto it.
Yes.
But
100%.
Like, 8 hours a week, homework. Oh, I totally forgot to do my homework this week. Anyway.
Bad student. Yeah. Bad student.
Well, you know, it's kind of at your own pace, and I've been pretty good at it. It's just totally forgot this week to do the test stuff. But it takes up so much time. And, you know, I kind of want to, like, I'm kind of looking forward to not being a student again so that I can be a dad and be a scout leader and maybe spend some time, I don't know, watching a television show or something.
Well, so Saturday we had a big scout event that we did. And as I was sitting there in between these stations that the different troops are doing, I was doing my homework because I had time to sit down and do nothing. I was like, I'm going to do some homework. And then I finally had my first shift at the ambulance company last night, which was awesome.
Would have been a perfect time to do your homework.
It would have been. And I did.
Uh-huh.
And I did. So had a little bit of downtime this weekend time to sit there and not necessarily be completely absorbed in something else to get it all done.
Yeah. Do you find when you're on shift, Jonathan, is that your opportunity to take, like, do you have a lot of downtime in the paramedic side or?
So it depends on the job or the role you're in in that particular moment. You know, I'm on this travel contract now, and it is go, go, go all the time.
Yeah.
Like there's no downtime whatsoever. But today I worked my 911 job here at home, and we ran one call today. And for the other part of the day, I sat and we had a student. So I talked to the student about some different things, and she was working on some different stuff, and she worked on homework, and she asked questions. But there was a lot of downtime today. But it's a mix. It all depends on where you're working and, you know, the community you're in and everything else.
What phase of training was she, or like, was she just starting school, halfway through school? Do you know?
So they're about, let's see, where are we, they're about, probably a little over halfway done.
Okay.
Yeah. They're a little over halfway done. But this was her, I want to say, I don't know, fourth ride or something like that.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she did great. You know, I don't usually have a whole lot of issue out of students. Most of them have a pretty good attitude, and I kind of set the expectation at the beginning.
He's like, you will listen to me. You will not disobey me. There's only one person in charge of this ambulance, and it's me. No,
no, I you know, even if they are young adults, I treat them like adults.
Yeah.
And the big things that I talk to them about are safety oriented things. So if we're in the ambulance and it's moving, you need to be wearing your seatbelt. And yes, sometimes that's hard to do, especially if you have a patient in the back, but otherwise you need to be wearing your seatbelt. The other thing is, hey, if we go out here on the highway, probably more than likely, and this just depends on the student, if they're already kind of involved in a department and used to doing that sort of thing and getting out on the highway and, you know, responding to calls, maybe I'll let them get out of the truck. But for the most part, I ask that they stay in the ambulance.
Okay,
and we will bring the patient to them. Mm-hmm. It's so dangerous being out there. It's honestly, I'd rather be in, you know, a burning building than be out on the highway. It scares me to death, to be honest.
Highways are terrifying.
It doesn't matter if you got blinking lights, sirens, people will blow through that stuff like it's nothing because they're here.
They don't care. Nope. So, so safety things are about the only thing we really talk about. Like I said, I don't have bad students come through. They just, sometimes they need a little more guidance, but no, it was a good day. Seemed like it was beneficial. She was absolutely willing to jump in and do whatever, that we needed her to do. So
sweet.
Nice. Good day.
I love it. I love the fact, like, I really enjoy the dynamic, especially it seems like the 911 side of things, like the community or EMS organizations, the firehouses, like it is the apprenticeship model, right? Like you're going through school, but I've not come across a place yet where they are not completely open to the idea of bringing in students and new people. Yep. Like you have to, that's how everyone learns. So,
yep.
Not everybody has a desire to interact with
students.
Oh, for
sure. Yeah.
But for the most part, for the most part, your different departments try to do a good job of like, hey, it'd be better to ride with, you know, Jonathan on this shift. Yeah. you know, we'll put you with him. So there's some strategy involved in making it a valuable learning experience.
Finding your best mentors is probably a huge deal for EMS organizations.
I already ran into one medic that I would not choose to be that person for me.
Yeah.
So
we all have that.
Yeah.
You run into it. And if you're listening to this and maybe you've had a bad experience, not everybody is going to be like that. Keep your chin up. Yep. You know,
and
you're going to interact with a lot of different kinds of people in this industry.
Yep. Yeah. And just talk to people. Like I cannot tell you how many options have been opened up for Max and I, just talking to people at class, talking to the instructors, like everybody knows something. And it is amazing to me how many people in the emergency services world in general, like they are like, oh yeah, I run with engine 33 here and I run with ladder 82 here and I run on ambulances here. And I'm also volunteering with this EMS, station over here. I'm like, why do you do so many? And it's because they're like, well, because I have friends that are there and they pulled me in, and I had friends that are here that pulled me in, and that this place pays well, and this place, you know, I get a lot of runs over here. I'm like, everybody seems to do
that. It seems like it's the same story for every student.
Yeah.
It's an all-encompassing career, right? Like once you and I say career, whether you're volunteering or whether you're paid, it doesn't matter. Once you're involved, it's hard to get this out of your system.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it already.
Speaking of drugs.
Yes, it is a drug.
Speaking of drugs.
It really is. Oh, man. Purpose. Speaking of which,
purpose.
There is a correlation to that. Not drugs in general, but just that feeling of being addicted to this lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
I gave for anybody listening, I gave these two guys homework this week. And I hope they do it so that we could talk about it on the next episode.
Man. Yeah, I still gotta do that.
Code 3 is so like I've just barely gotten into the EMS life. And that movie got me. I'm like, oh my God, this is like they did their research with this, yeah. Like hardcore.
I can tell you a TV show that you should not bother watching.
Oh, I know. We're not talking about that right now, but I'm just saying, like, you know, Code 3, definitely, like, you should go watch it. It is really good. Rainn Wilson does a great job, but, like, I guarantee you'll watch it and go, this feels like it's kind of comedy, but it's like, so raw and real that you're gonna be like, yeah, this is exactly what this is. This is
all the clips I've seen. I can 100% relate to them.
I mean, it's funny, but it's almost like, ooh, that's almost too funny. Like that's almost like that hits too. That hurts.
It's close to home.
It's close to home. But yeah, so definitely check out Code 3. And we're going to use that as a segue because we actually have a few things this week that we want to tell you about. For instead of doing a sponsorship, we're actually going to tell you a bit of a highlight on some resources or some things that we have found entertaining or informational, just so that you can go out there and find them. Yep. And you can use those to your advantage as well. And this week, instead of that sponsor, I have a book recommendation. Max has a book recommendation. And then Jonathan has a book recommendation as well. Mine is, it's one book that I just finished as of last night. Well, audiobook, because I don't do the reading. My mind races too much and I fall asleep reading. But I just did two audiobooks in a row by Kevin Grange. And he is a paramedic from out in Los Angeles. He was a writer before he became a paramedic. He wrote Lights and Sirens, which is his story of becoming a paramedic. And he then wrote a book called Wild Rescues, which is his story of becoming a National Park Service paramedic. Well, actually, he's a National Park Service ranger and a paramedic ranger. And he worked at Yellowstone, Yosemite, and Grand Teton. Mm. And it's like, you know, the story of him transitioning from being a like city EMT or city paramedic, you know, with all the resources at his disposal to going to this wilderness lifestyle and becoming what he calls an all hazards responder. And now I'm like, I need to go work for the National Park Service. And
we've lost Mike.
Yeah. You'll see me. I need a flat hat.
He'll be working at a Glacier National Park in Montana.
I would totally work. If anybody at Glacier National Park ever hears this and they're like, hey, we'll bring you in as an intern, I will do it. I will come work at Glacier National Park as an EMT for free.
His beard's going to grow larger.
Yeah. My heart will grow 10 times too big, but in like the funny Grinch way, not in the, you know.
Yeah,
in the bad cardiac type of way. In the myocarditis type of way.
Yes.
But yeah, so that's my recommendation and my highlight for this week.
Yes. For me, a book I read when I was 14. That was one of the first fiction books I ever picked up and got addicted to reading. It's called Heart of the Storm by L.H. Burris. And it was a fictional viewpoint of the Gulf War. But one of the group of characters in the book is a combat medic team that runs an ambulance. And they're basically running into fire. They're pulling guys out of tanks because it was very tank-centric. It was the first fiction book I read as like that I can remember. And it really just – it's still to this day, it still hits home, those excerpts. And they were very graphic, very real, very dirty, very grimy. Really, 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 really good book.
Nice. That's cool.
Awesome. So my recommendation is more of a reference material book. It is the Ranger Medic Handbook, the 2025 edition. It's sold to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. And it entails all the different things that 75th Ranger Regiment are doing in their tactical medical kind of practices. And it's updated, you know, pretty frequently to keep up with evidence-based medicine and best practices. I have found it invaluable. And a copy of it rides in my tactical medical bag, just as a quick reference. If I were to need that, and we were doing some extended field type care, it is invaluable. It's got drug formularies in it. It's got, just different flow charts. It's got some extended care stuff in it. It's a great resource if you're into tactical medicine. And I definitely want to recommend that.
Super sweet. Cool. Yeah, I do really enjoy books like that. Well, those are the ones that you have a hard time reading cover to cover, right? Because they're more of a reference manual. Yeah, but sure. They are so great for, hey, I wonder what the take is on this particular thing. And that whatever that topic or chapter is devoted to that, mm-hmm. like it gives you that succinct kind of like, oh, I'm just going to dive into this one thing, see what the Rangers talk about. Like, I am a fan of reference materials like that.
Yeah.
It's even got like guidance on when to pull somebody off of operational status. And it talks about aviators as well, pulling them off of operational status, if they have a condition or if they receive a medication. So yeah. It's a great reference material, and I'm working my way through it little by little and learning that stuff. So
nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's great. Great opportunity for somebody to learn a little bit more about tactical medicine.
Yeah. So, and opportunities that you guys can kind of see and reach out. Like, I think all of us in different ways have started kind of branching out and really diving into different aspects of EMS. And mm-hmm. like there's so many resources out there. So if you find this interesting, if you're like, oh yeah, let me hear some more, shoot us a note. We'll definitely kind of share some of these resources along the way, things that we find inspirational or really, useful or just generally informative.
And like, if you have your own, please.
Oh yeah. Share them with us too. Please shoot us a note.
Share this with us. We would be more than happy to, go over it, put links up for people to also be able to reference it. Like, please send them in.
Ridealongpodcasting@gmail.com, or you can reach out to Mike@bulletin.net. So, very cool. Thank you guys for sharing. Mm-hmm. I like that. I like being able to kind of like share those types of, things with people. So we should chat about what we're talking like. I guess there is a purpose for this podcast. We could sit and BS all night about everything, but we do want to get through our topic.
Yes, we do.
Which is drugs.
Drugs.
Medications.
All the drugs.
All the drugs. Not the fun drugs. Wait,
no. Well, it depends.
They're not.
Well, they're the good drugs, but not the fun drugs.
Yeah. So I guess some of the good drugs can be fun. I don't know. I don't.
I know for a fact that when I heard them rattling off when they did their pharmacological check on the bus, they were rattling off some of the names like, interesting.
Oh, yeah. Like Jonathan gets to play with the good drugs. Stuff. Yeah.
We've got aspirin and oxygen for you.
Yeah. Oxygen. I like how they started with oxygen. They're like, that's a drug. It's like the most common drug that you're going to give to people is oxygen. I'm like,
it is.
Yeah, that's true. Because you could get some euphoric effects from oxygen as well.
But sure.
Yeah. Like it's just interesting. Like we're starting such small world is like the mm-hmm. BLS side, the basic life support side of administration of drugs. And then just starts branching out from there.
I figure we cover what, 0.5% or 5% of the total? Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a, and I mean, like just, it all depends on the area, right? Like I've got drugs at my travel position that I don't have access to here in my 911 gig. So, I mean, I'm having to learn new drugs all the time.
Oh,
based on. Yeah. So it's not a static thing. And in some areas
all the time.
What are you talking about? Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. It's like, you gotta, continue to learn.
Critically, you mean we have to critically think, oh, I'm done. It's over for me.
I just want to go through EMT school one time and never learn anything again. I'm good. Perfect to go. After that one time going through school.
Exactly. Like any other class. Once you take it once, you're good. It's all you need.
But yeah, so this week we're talking about drugs,
yep.
And more importantly, because there's a million drugs out there, and yeah. I can actually attest to that because my last 20 years of my life have been dealing with, I've been a drug dealer. I've been slinging drugs the last 20 years.
He's made them sexy and fancy.
Well, yeah, I've definitely made them professional or approachable or sexy or informative. Like, I take, you know, legitimate business practices and
brands. Did you get, like, notes like, okay, make this sexy, it's boring now?
I have actually worked on brands that are like, can we make this drug sexier? And it's disturbing. So I've been working in pharmaceuticals the last 20 years or so, but I do get a little bit of a leg up in some of the terminology and understanding and pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and PK curves. A PK curve is a pharmacokinetic curve. I understand, like, that stuff I learned 20 years ago, like, scratching my head and drooling at the board when people are like, yeah, you need to learn this for your job. I'm like, but I just make things look good. I'm a designer. And they're like, nope, you got to learn science. I'm like, okay, I'm in. So actually it's fun because this week I get to present an idea or a medical term of the week, which I actually learned like 20 years ago, like straight out of college with my graphic arts degree. I got a job in pharmaceutical advertising, and I quickly had to learn a whole bunch of things. Chiefly, the most important of those was indications and contraindications. So anytime you're talking about drugs, they have a specific indication for what they're used for. Mm-hmm. So for instance, aspirin in our EMS circles mm-hmm. has a very specific indication for chest pain of suspected cardiac origin.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Yep.
You can't give somebody aspirin, or like as an EMT, we can't give somebody aspirin for a headache.
Right.
No. Because it's not indicated for that for our purposes. It does not mean that it's not indicated for that in an over-the-counter space. So somebody right. can go to Walgreens and buy, you know, aspirin for a headache. We can't administer for it because we're held to a specific set of indications that we're allowed to use it for.
Correct.
So the FDA has the FDA isn't controlling what we're doing, but the FDA in general, as the drugs come out to the market, sets an indication saying, yes, these drugs can be legally sold for this indication, right?
Right.
So for that, it's chest pain of a suspected cardiac origin. That's one of the legal indications for aspirin. Oral glucose, you know, one of the legal indications is hypoglycemia. So it can be used for blood sugar under 60 milligrams per deciliter.
Right.
So if someone's hypoglycemic, they can be, we as EMTs, will be able to administer oral glucose for that indication. However, in that idea, they're like, okay, so you can take this drug and you can use it for this particular thing. There is also contraindications.
Right.
It means what is it not indicated for? Or I should say specifically, when is it not allowed to be used?
Right.
Right?
Like, are there any signs you should not be giving this thing to this person?
Exactly. Right. So a good example of that is one of the drugs that we learned about this week is nitroglycerin,
yep.
which originally, the first time I ever heard about nitroglycerin, I was like, oh, cool. Do you mean I can like take the little pills out of the bottle and just throw them at people? And they go, boom.
That'd be fun.
No, it's not that cool, unfortunately. It's stabilized, apparently. I'm like, it'd be way boring, cooler if it wasn't.
Boring, boring.
Nitroglycerin is the key component of TNT, by the way, yes. For anybody interested, they stabilize it is it vasodilator? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a vasodilator. It opens up the blood vessels.
Yep. I mean, that's super interesting to know that a compound that is so volatile that it can explode if you accidentally drop it is also something that if you ingest it, it dilates your blood vessels. Wait,
so if we get a stick of dynamite and we crack that bitch open, and we just start rubbing and just start rubbing.
Eat it like a beef stick.
Exactly.
I think that the medical discovery of it was almost by accident. They were using it in their as an explosive and the other industrial uses they use, and they were noticing folks getting headaches and passing out, and
that's true. So,
and there was one guy who was having a heart attack, and his pain stopped because he accidentally got topical application of nitroglycerin. I mean, it might have happened.
Well, dynamite used to sweat.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
But Sorry, back onto the topic of contraindication. So nitroglycerin has a contraindication for low blood pressure. So if if somebody's blood pressure is under 100 systolic, 100 milligrams of mercury systolic, that or if they've taken erectile dysfunction drugs within the last 24 hours or 48 hours, depending on the like the medical direction in your area. At all, like I guess that's one of the things that changes.
Like, there's so many companies making that in so many different fashions. Like, it is everywhere. Like,
well,
trying to keep on top of that and make sure that that's not what's going on. It's got to be tough.
But so if somebody has taken an ED drug or has a blood pressure under 100 milligrams of mercury, then it is contraindicated in that instance because nitroglycerin lowers the blood pressure.
It does.
Vasodilators lower the blood pressure. So those two things would have what's called synergistic effects.
Yep.
And you could not just – well, and drugs are weird because synergistic effects mean that they don't just add. It's not like 1 + 1 = 2. Sometimes if you have synergistic effects from drugs, it means that 1 + 1 equals 30.
It's a geometric progression.
They can compound each other. Yep. So
100%.
I mean, it's one of the wonders of the human body that we have found, or wonders of science that we have found these items and things in nature that we've been able to kind of synthesize or pull out of the ground. Like aspirin, for instance, is an organic compound, I think, made from the willow tree. It's acetylsalicylic acid. And they figured out over the years that that just works it does something with platelets. Do you know what it does, Jonathan?
Yeah. So it's an anti-aggregate or anti-platelet.
Yes. Thank you.
So it doesn't allow blood cells or red blood cells to aggregate or to build up. So if you theoretically already have a blockage of some sort, we are not potentially worsening that blockage and causing more ischemic injury or injury due to lack of oxygen to the heart.
Right.
And so, you know for a fact that our great-great-great-great-grandparents knew what all those little herbs and things did, and then someone came along and say, we're going to patent that shit.
Well, that is true, but you know, some of that stuff is also just used from experience. Mm-hmm. And then like somebody did come along and go, hey, you know what? Let me figure out the science behind this. Mm-hmm. And then they actually, you know, they put a lot of effort and like, it's very not often that I defend the pharmaceutical industry.
He's defending them. he's still on the hook.
However, there is a lot of time and money invested into it. There should be some level of like, you know, payoff, compensation, reward for the efforts that go in. I do not deny that, but I am very critical of the patent process. I've seen it many times. Anyway, let me not get onto that side, that topic.
That'll be an hour conversation all on its own.
Sorry, I'm digressing. Drugs, contraindications, indications, you have to know them for what you're using them for.
Yep.
There is such a thing as off-label usage, meaning the label is the indication. Some doctors can choose to prescribe drugs for what's considered to be off label, but we are not doing that in terms of the context of EMT school. We are looking at the indications that are allowed under the protocols that we work under.
The simple way to put it is for indications, when and why am I going to use it? And for contraindications, when and why not am I going to use it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but that's the big thing you have to remember. There's a time and a place for everything.
Yep.
And medications included.
Exactly. So
yep.
That's our medical term of the week is indications and contraindications. And as we go through the other medications tonight, that's going to be reiterated several times
because 100%.
Each one of the drugs that we use or that we're allowed to administer, either the ones that we could administer ourselves or help patients with, they all have indications and contraindications.
I mean, this is basically the rule set for everything going forward in the pharmacological subject.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, that's our rule set.
Hand in hand.
This is what we have to follow.
Yep.
And different eight paramedics and EMTs are going to have different standards and different access.
Yeah, they have different scope of practice for sure.
Yeah.
So, that's our term. which leads us into tonight's topics are all the things that we went through in class. And there's a bunch, right? Like,
this was heavy. I mean, this was a lot of information.
It was.
In a relatively short period of time. Like, it was definitely a huge download of info. It was like
half a class.
Yeah.
We actually had two topics that night, which are being broken into separate episodes.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting there and I took like 5 pages of notes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is too much info for like us to digest in one go. So it was a lot.
Yeah, when you messaged me, I was like minutes away from like, dude, there's no way we're being able to cover both of these.
In the middle of class, so. I'm like, this is not going to be a single episode. Yes. We have to break this up.
Yes.
And the other topic, and this is just us chatting about the idea of EMT school. Sometimes you will have nights where you're talking about completely separate topics. I've realized that like they've been pretty good so far in terms of like, hey, we're going to talk about airways and respiratory system. Oh. Okay, those two things are related. This was the first time it was like, we're going to talk about pharmacology and respiratory emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, those are
very different.
They are linked
because
you use some pharmacological items in respiratory emergencies. Yes.
Right.
But there's not a lot of common ground in between those two. Like, there is so much information in respiratory emergencies. By the way, make sure you stick around for the next week's episode, which is going to be respiratory emergencies. I think a good place to start is the thing that's probably the most important for us.
Yes.
As providers is kind of like the check, the thing that they reiterated several times that night. Now, Jonathan, let me ask you a question. When you went through EMT school and when you practice, is the idea of the 5 rights a common thing?
It is 100%. Okay. And some, not to detract from the 5 rights. So we'll stick with that because that's what you guys are learning in class.
It's the curriculum, like the NREMT.
Yeah. Yeah. But some places even add some extra rights to those 5 rights, just to go ahead and even further ensure that we're doing what we need to be doing. But we just understand that wherever you are learning, you may have some additional rights that you need to understand and comprehend for your class.
And we're obviously talking about the right to free speech.
Absolutely.
The right to fair representation.
Yes.
The right to bear arms. The right to have
free assembly.
Freedom of assembly. No, I'm joking.
Yes.
The 5 rights is the check that we use to make sure that whatever medication we are going to administer is correct. Like is 100%. We're mitigating as much risk as humanly possible in going through asking these 5 questions.
And number one is, do you have the right patient?
That might
be important.
Yeah, maybe.
It might just be important.
Well, so here's something. It sounds very obvious, especially if you only have one patient. But we're going to talk about some drugs and we're going to talk about the concept of EMT-administered drugs versus EMT-assisted drugs.
Yeah.
And one of the big aspects of assisted medications, it has to belong to that patient.
Right.
They have to have a prescription for it.
Mm-hmm. Not Uncle Joe's pills that were left over from the last time he went to the doctor that are in the medicine cabinet. But
it's not an uncommon thing to show up on a chest pain call and somebody has pulled out a bottle of nitro that belonged to grandpa and it's not theirs and they happen to start taking it, but it's not prescribed to them. And so you can't assist them with that, or maybe they've already taken it, which is sometimes even worse.
But I think the nitro is a really good case. The one that I can imagine happening very likely is, responding to somebody who has gotten a bad allergic reaction.
Yeah.
Sure.
We can't in Pennsylvania. And I believe that nationally, we can't administer epinephrine epinephrine auto injectors.
Right.
But we can assist a patient with their auto injector.
Assuming,
But we cannot assist a patient with an auto injector if it's not their auto injector. Right. Like it has to be their prescription.
Yes.
And there's reasons for that. Like, right. We can't just go beyond it. We can't just be like, oh, I know what I'm doing. Like, I know I can, like, epinephrine's for this. Like, we're not doctors. Like, we have to check ourselves with that. So it has to be the right patient, not just from the, like, oh, it, we could, like, you know, theoretically a drug for somebody else could be used on a patient, but also because it's very easy to accidentally use the wrong medicine accidentally on a patient.
Yeah.
Right.
So you always have to check to make sure you have the right patient.
And, right. And when you mix into that, like, the cost of EpiPens.
Sure.
You know, so there may be, you know, an impetus to use this thing because we have this one. Even though it's prescribed for mom, it's also there for dad and the kids because, you know, if we need one, we have one.
Right.
Because of the cost.
Yeah.
You know, so I guarantee we're going to see that happen.
I would bet, you know. Yeah, I mean, just those two drugs alone, I think are yep. rather like they're
yeah.
those are quagmires for us because I'm sure those will pop up, like the drug being used for somebody else. So we need the right patient. Number two, we need the right medication, which
right.
seems got self-explanatory, but got it. Sometimes like you need to make sure that little bottle of aspirin is actually aspirin or
you,
not.
You mean there might be a different thing in the bottle?
Well, it could be a different thing in the bottle, or you might just grab the wrong bottle.
Because they all look the same.
Yeah, like aspirin, like the little white tablets of aspirin look like little white tablets of morphine. Like,
yeah,
you know, you got to make sure you grab the right one.
Yeah.
Make sure it says on the bottle, aspirin. you need the right dose.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, yeah. Like all of these drugs have indicated dosages that are associated with their indication.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that has to be in line. Like you can't just give somebody a double dose of Epi if the first one isn't working.
Right.
Like those have repercussions. Now a doctor can choose to make decisions like that because they have a medical license to be able to prescribe. So they might even tell you that you could do something like that.
Right.
Through medical command. Like, which drug is it that we can ask to do? I think it's nitro. Like we can right. We can assist a patient in taking their first dose of nitro.
Yes.
But if that isn't offering relief, we can call a medical director yep. and they can indicate, or they can give us authorization to help them with another dosage. Right. So we can't make that decision to give them extra. But a doctor might be able to.
Well, he's had the education to be able to tell him what can
exactly.
and can't happen.
Yeah. They're experts.
Well, yes.
So you need the right dose. You need the right time. What does that mean?
Now, that was my... So is that just frequency of administration?
It can be. It can be...
Because it seemed very, very kind of... gray on what they were referring to that as.
Yeah, it can be like, you know, so you can, we just talked about nitro and being able to administer a second dose or assist administration with a second dose if you have medical direction. Mm-hmm. But there's a time frame of 5 minutes in between.
Right.
You know,
right.
Readministering. So... you know, you have to make sure that you're within that correct window to be able to administer. Because if you're too soon, you can have issues.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it mainly probably deals with frequency of dosing.
Yeah.
Like when was the last time they had, like if it's a drug that's indicated that it can't be used within a certain amount of time of a last dosage, then
yeah,
you have to.
And
you
know, like, what did they take before you got there?
Well,
like,
that's
did they already take a dose and it's been 2 minutes and it hasn't been given time to take effect?
They took all of it. That's
all of it.
Just they took it all.
Yep.
Open the mouth, the dump it in.
And then the last right is the right route.
Yeah.
Which is the form of administration, right? So is it tablets? Is it a spray? Like nitro is one of those ones that actually comes in multiple different routes. So they have the tablets, they have oral spray, they have topical administration that you could put on the chest, which I hear is stupid. Or at least everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone that I've heard talk about it, they're like, yeah, that one.
It's a thing, but yeah. No.
Yeah. We'd prefer not to have that. So, yeah, you need to have the five rights,
mm-hmm.
the right patient, the right medication, the right dose, the right time, the right route. So you ask yourself that every single time that you're
every time,
every single time.
And I think it like I think it should be done. You should be doing it audibly. Like there is a difference between saying the thing and thinking the thing.
Yeah. You should probably do it with your own medications too. Like throughout life in general, you have kids that you give medications to. You should probably do all of that every time you deal with medications. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the common sense approach, which gets formalized because you have more responsibility when you're doing it for other people.
Yeah. You have an onus that they're looking to you as a medical professional.
Yep.
And you know, you should fulfill that role, not just be some jerk off that's going to do whatever you think is right.
Yep. So, the five rights.
Yes.
And there's one also very important question to ask along with the five rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, are you allergic to this?
Mm-hmm. Like, yes.
Like double check. Because part of the secondary assessment is asking about mm-hmm. allergies, right? In part, in the sample, right? Allergies, medications. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get fluid with the idea of, you know, the secondary assessment.
Yeah.
Mnemonics.
Yes.
But the, you know, they may forget to say that, oh yeah, I'm allergic to penicillin. Okay. Well, I don't have penicillin. Right. And then when you give okay, I got this aspirin, I'm going to give you this aspirin. Wait a second. Are you allergic to aspirin? Oh yeah. Yes, I am. I'm like, well, good thing I asked.
And right. You should probably ask every time before you administer.
So every time you're going to administer a drug, you should ask if they are not allergic to it.
Because that could be bad.
Slightly.
Yeah.
So
just a little bit.
And one of the reasons to talk about why do we use the five rights, we utilize things like the five rights because under stress and you're definitely going to encounter some stressful situations in EMS. Under stress, we like to have these things we can rely upon. And if you learn the five rights, then that's something when you're a little stressed out, you can revert back to. Mm-hmm. Same thing with our mnemonic mm-hmm. devices that we utilize, our sample history and our OQPRST. So that's one of the important reasons we utilize it the way we do.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's where we started. And I think mm-hmm. that's the thing that we keep coming back to is like, okay, anything we deal with medications, we have to be double sure, triple sure, mm-hmm. like making sure we're sure. So now that we understand what we should do to check, we do have to understand, and we mentioned it before, but I think it bears repeating, there are really two classes of drugs that we'll be dealing with as EMS professionals. There are administered drugs that we based off of a protocol, an online protocol, an offline protocol that has a certain set of criteria that if it gets met, that we can help administer, like we could just administer.
Yep.
Versus drugs that we don't necessarily have and can give to somebody, but if they have it themselves,
right.
we can assist. Right. So those are two big differences. Means we could still help, but there is a clear line between those. We can have drugs that we can give people versus they can have drugs of their own that we can help with.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So the first class is the drugs that we can administer.
Yeah.
Right.
And we've mentioned a few of them already, and we don't have to go crazy deep into them. But aspirin probably being the one that's most ubiquitous because it really has very little chance of doing anything bad. Apparently, like I looked into possible side effects and or like incidences of ill effects from aspirin, and there aren't many unless you're allergic like that. Then it's bad.
Yeah.
But the big one is heart pain or suspected heart pain or sorry, heart pain from a suspected cardiac source.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Yep. Chest pain.
And it's kind of like, oh, you're having chest pain. Take these. Wait, are you allergic? Take these. So it's kind of like, you know, immediate answer.
Yes.
Let's get this stuff on board, right? Jonathan mentioned it's an antiplatelet. It helps with you know, basically keeping those clots, whatever the clot is, from getting any worse in the heart if they're having a heart attack.
Right.
Contraindicated. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's just think of it as it lubricates, provides some lubricity to the platelets or to the red blood cells.
Lubricity.
Mm. Lubricity, yeah. It lubricates the blood cells so they don't stick together, mm-hmm, even if there is some blockage forming.
Yep.
So hopefully we don't make it worse.
Man, I need some more of that lubricity in my life. it does have a few contraindications. So an allergy to aspirin or NSAIDs is one of the ones that you know, you cannot give it if somebody says they have an allergy to that. GI bleeds or ulcers, which makes sense because it's an item that helps make the blood more lubretic. No, it's a lubricated.
Lubris.
So it could influence and then exasperate previous bleeding as well. So,
right. And especially bleeding in the GI tract, which isn't necessarily going to be seen.
Could be bad. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's the whole deal is, you know, when you start to think about trauma, we want clots to form. Right?
Yes.
We're always balancing this of, we would like a clot to form so we can, you know, keep the blood in the body, mm-hmm, versus we don't want clots to form so those clots don't
travel around the body,
travel around the body and cause other issues. So, and aspirin, if we have some sort of trauma or some sort of other medical condition that, you know, causes active bleeding somewhere, we don't want to make that a thing.
Yeah. So the GI bleeds, the ones they specifically mentioned were GI bleeds and head trauma.
Yeah. You
know, so definitely not give them the standard dose of, hey, take these aspirin if they're like, my chest hurts. Yeah, but your head is caved in and you're bleeding from your abdomen. So like, we're not going to give you the aspirin right now. I don't think you're going to mind. I don't think you're going to be too focused on the aspirin not getting in.
Right.
And it has standard dosage. So the typical dosage that it seems like is on most EMS services is the baby aspirin, which comes in 81 milligram chewable pills.
Right.
And you get four of those. It's 324 milligrams. Although they said 325.
So how do you shave off that one extra milligram?
So the dosage is 325, but the pills are 81 milligrams. And you get four of them, which is 324. It's a number that doesn't add up exactly, but it's apparently what they do.
That's a weird thing. And somewhere along the line, one book said this and another book said that. And, you know, we just kind of bounce in between 324, 325 and roll with it. it's one of those weird things in medicine.
You gotta, there's only the dust at the bottom of the bottle. You can just like gather some of the dust.
Now, so we have a mutual friend that that believes that all pills are chewable pills. I tried to emphasize, you probably should get some chewable. He's like, all of them are chewable. And I'm like, well, yes.
I mean, they're not necessarily made to be.
Here's one of the things to consider with giving aspirin and why we like having the 81 milligram chewables. A lot of people are on a daily aspirin already. And so if you catch them in a time where they have went ahead and taken their daily aspirin, like immediately following their breakfast or, you know, picking them up at night and they've immediately taken that aspirin, we don't want to give them more. It's probably not going to hurt them, but it's not a good idea to go ahead and give them more on top of the standard dose. Just as a practice, again, probably not going to hurt anybody, but this is not medical advice. But we can kind of go ahead and give them the appropriate dose related to what they've already taken.
Sure. Yeah.
So
makes sense. Yeah. Yes. If they take one baby aspirin a day, you give them three baby aspirin and then, you know, you make up for the extra dose.
And that's usually just following like immediately or pretty quickly after having taken their daily medicines. So
yeah, aspirin is a big one, and it has shown significant improvement in numbers of people surviving heart attacks from just chewing on some aspirin.
Simple little pill. Yep.
So we have aspirin. Oral glucose is the next one we went over, and this one is relatively easy to understand. It's syrup in a tube.
Yes.
It's sugar.
Apparently strawberry flavored.
I bet you they probably have other flavors.
They have other flavors. Okay.
But
yeah, I've seen lemon and grape.
It's indicated for hypoglycemia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Low blood sugar.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So I believe that's under 60 milligrams per deciliter. So 60 on a glucometer, right?
Yes. And this is, again, this is not medical advice, but even somebody maybe that, and follow your protocols, but even somebody that maybe is not, they're having issues, but they're not quite below 60.
Mm-hmm.
It could still be indicated depending on what your protocol says, yep, if they have a little bit of an altered mental status. So it just depends. But yeah, 60 is, if we had a number to pick, based on protocols, 60 is what it's going to be.
And from what they told us, I've never experienced this. I actually have never seen, like, usually if I'm around people who are diabetic, they've been pretty well managed. And if they do get hypoglycemic, they're usually like, oh, I need to grab an orange juice or something along those lines. And they can usually even themselves out. But they said that the oral glucose is like, it's like super fast. Like it works real, mm-hmm, fast, and it goes away real fast. Yep. Like it just makes, yes, this big spike to kind of give them. So they have to then, you know, already be ready with like, okay, so then make sure you have some juice on hand, mm-hmm, so that you could start, you know, like keeping that at the level that it needs to be at instead of, right, just relying on the glucose.
And even something more solid than that, you, yeah, know, just that they've got to get some sugar in them and something that is even, you know, a little bit of fat, a little bit of protein as well, if we can help it. Something that's, sure, going to have some staying power.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we try and make somebody a sandwich.
Yep.
But the whole purpose is we raise that blood sugar up enough to alleviate some of maybe their altered mental status or, you know, whatever issue they've got going on, however they're feeling, probably going to be altered mental status.
Yeah.
So we get it up with that oral glucose and then they're kind of feeling better. And so we go ahead and take that opportunity to get them something a little more solid.
Yep. So it has 15 grams of sugar, mm-hmm, in it, or of glucose, which is actually, this is a pretty good amount of glucose. Like it's basically like a can of Coke, I believe. Mm-hmm. That's like 15 grams, maybe 20. Not sure off the top of my head, but it's like all in a little slurry tube, and it can be either oral. Well, it's only indicated for our protocols to be given orally, mm-hmm, and that's because the patient needs to be conscious. However, they did tell us that old school EMS people have had success in administering it. I had to look up this term because I didn't know what it meant. Buccally.
Yeah.
Where it's rubbing it on the inside of the cheek.
Yeah. So, and really buccally is like when I learned it in EMT school, it is an oral administration, but we're using, you know, a tongue depressor to put it buccally.
Yeah.
And do that because, your mouth has a lot of vasculature in it,
yep,
and does absorb things pretty quickly.
Digestion actually starts in the mouth. Like, yep, it's like from saliva. With sugar.
So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is protecting the airway.
Yeah.
The hope is that, you know, we get them up a little bit and they're not like, they don't have the sugar draining down their throat, potentially causing airway problems.
All right. Now, I know you're asleep, but just hold still. You know, just squirt it on in.
It'll be fine.
I have seen that. I've answered calls where somebody was gurked out and you know, the family, they had good intentions, but they're putting all sorts of things in their mouth while they're like basically unresponsive. Oh,
yeah.
And now like, they're choking and now they've aspirated it. And
yeah.
And soon they'll be dead.
Yeah.
It's like, can we not do that, please?
So yeah, oral glucose, one of those ones that we can administer. And like, it's also one of those ones that like, if somebody's having a problem, that fixes it. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, it's not going to be often that at, you know, in the EMS world where you get to fix a problem. And that's kind of one of them. Cause
I've seen that firsthand with a friend's son who was, for whatever reason on the weekends, like he would wake up altered almost every morning,
mm-hmm,
and them having to hold him down to get something in his mouth. And then it was like a light switch. It, mm-hmm, was crazy.
Yeah, people apparently get weird when mm-hmm. When they get low blood sugar. I just get hangry. No,
that's most of us.
Yeah, I know. It's just everybody. So, yeah. So we have oral glucose. Then we had we went through probably the one that we will be administering
all the time.
The most common drug in EMS.
It's almost like on the ambulance, they even have a giant section of the ambulance devoted just to that drug.
Yeah, a whole compartment just for this one drug. It's so prolific that we are all breathing it in right now.
Yes. We're all on
constantly.
It.
We're all on it. We're hooked on it. It's oxygen.
Yes.
It's kind of essential.
It's almost like it's necessary or something.
But yeah, it's considered to be a drug. You know, it does have effects. It does have indications and contraindications. So it is an intervention that we can have, and we use it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, I've only been on 4 ride-alongs, and I've administered oxygen, like, at this point. Like, it's, like, the first thing that you do is, like, hey, put oxygen on them. Like, just put it on. Like, put the oxygen on. Like, that nasal cannula, get it on there. Like, we're getting CO2 readings. You might as well put oxygen on while you're doing it.
Right.
So, oxygen is a big one. And indications are hypoxia, mm-hmm. Anything under 94% on the old SpO2 meter. What is that thing called? Pulse oximeter.
Pulse
ox.
Yeah.
Man, I'm having a rough time remembering. There's so many new terms. And then regardless of what that number says, respiratory distress or poor perfusion gets oxygen.
Yeah. And even if they're anxious, if it's a psychosomatic thing of, hey, I'm going to do this thing for you, and they think that you're doing something for them by just putting a nasal cannula in, just as a way to get their head in the game.
Yeah.
you should actually give them oxygen if you're gonna do that. I'm gonna say that.
What you shouldn't do is stick the hose on the wrong nozzle on the oxygen bottle.
You had the best of intentions, Mike. Okay.
And the important part,
I'm never gonna let myself live it
down. The important part is he got it on.
So I made it. I felt like I had that redeeming moment the other day because I went on my next shift after I put it on the wrong mm-hmm. oxygen bottle, and like they were like, okay, can you hook that up? And I go, it goes on that one. and I made sure to step. I'm like, and I was like, this doesn't look like it should go on that. Like, now that I'm really looking at it, like it looks like the nozzle or the receptacle is like wider than it should be. And I'm like, let me just, oh yeah, it totally goes on that. Like, that's where it goes.
And all the instructors are like, wait, you got it on that thing? I'm just like, they were very impressed that he was able to get the tube onto what he got.
Yeah.
It onto.
They're like, you put it on the, what was it? The bypass valve or something.
Yeah.
I'm like, it looked like that's where it went. But yeah. So make sure you put it on the wrong, or put it on the right, on the right nozzle. So it's indicated for, low or hypoxia and respiratory distress, poor perfusion. It does have a contraindication. Do you know what it is?
A contraindication for it?
Yeah.
For COPD?
But yes.
That's if they're inside of that range for COPD.
Right.
If they're not under 88?
Well, technically, it's not necessarily a total contraindication because you can give a patient with COPD oxygen. You just don't want to give them so much oxygen that you're pumping them up above what their normal SpO2 reading is.
Right. So like they were saying that normally they stay generally between 88 and 93. So if you read a patient with COPD in that range, that's their normal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, when I got into EMS, the hope was, we can hyperoxygenate people. We're going to get them all the way to 100 and we want to keep them at 100. And that was kind of the thought process 15 years ago. But now it's, and for several years it's been, no, we're going to titrate to an SpO2 of 94%. Because there are issues with being at a high rate of oxygen and a high SpO2 percentage for too long, there are issues with that in the body, and so we just want to stay within that range of 90.
You want to keep their body used to the right. amount of oxygen that they're used to getting.
Yeah.
Or it could be I've experienced different altitudes of oxygen. Like, you can get sick from it, from having too much or too little.
I came out of a back surgery once, and they put me on an on rebreather, and I passed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm not feeling right, and I was gone. I was out cold.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I don't know what the reason was, but, you know, they brought me back in, and then it went from non rebreather to just a cannula. Because for whatever reason, knocked me straight out.
Yeah. You got to make sure that reservoir is full of air or full of oxygen. And also, some people, if they're like really, really, really breathing fast or they're really in distress, they're just not going to tolerate feeling like they're smothered on their face.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things. But yeah, in general, there are no contraindications for oxygen. You just got to be cautious of what we call the hypoxic drive of the COPDers. So
those are most of the administered drugs. And then there's one more that I would consider, I assume, to be the new kid on the block of administered drugs from the EMS side. Yeah. But it's so ubiquitous that almost everybody out there carries some of this nowadays, like as an emergency drug to administer for a very specific purpose.
Yep.
Right.
And what would it be? Naloxone, also known as Narcan.
Narcan. I mean, like the blight on our society that is opioids. It is. I mean, when you first started in EMS, Jonathan, was Naloxone a drug for EMS?
No, not at all. I mean, the ALS providers, you know, obviously had access to it, especially, you know, if you're giving narcotics to people, you want to be able to fix that problem.
If a dose
causes an issue, but we did not have that was really at the start of, kind of the opioid crisis in America. And, probably before it hit that crisis level. And so we did not see that sort of thing as frequently and as widespread as we currently do. So it was just not something. But yeah, basically anybody with a little bit of training can get Narcan over the counter.
Yeah, I don't even think you need the training. You could, like, they give it out like candy up here.
Yeah.
Fire departments and police departments now in Philly just give it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's usually the little nasal, nasal spray one.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't something. And then within like probably the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, maybe 8 years, it's become more of an EMT level type drug.
Yeah.
Now, you know, in our show notes, we're kind of looking at the different routes of administration, and protocols are going to kind of drive that.
Yeah.
So we've got the intranasal route, right? The nasal spray. Mm-hmm. And then we also have an intramuscular injection that you can give somebody. And then also titrating to respirations. As a paramedic, I can absolutely and will absolutely titrate that to a person's respiratory drive, right? Just I want them to wake up just enough for them to start breathing again, and not enough to be combative and cause other issues.
Now, Jonathan, I have to throw a wrench in your works right now because I love how we check each other on our pro speak.
Uh-huh.
What does titrate mean?
Yes, titrate. Yeah, so we are going to adjust the dosage, or titrating is adjusting the dosage of something to the effectiveness of it.
Right. You can titrate up or you can titrate down. Like, it's adjusting the medication for the desired effect, right?
Yes. Okay. No, I appreciate you catching me.
No, because I'm like, I know that word for like the last 20 years, but I'm pretty sure not everybody knows that word.
So, but that is not being able to titrate or adjust that medication up or down to somebody's respiratory drive is not necessarily an EMT level skill mm-hmm. in all localities. So it's something the dosage and then the route are both things that may be a little different depending on where you are. If you're listening somewhere else outside of Virginia or Pennsylvania,
you know, what's funny. And I don't know if this is the same everywhere, but in most of the stories where I've heard of the administration of Narcan,
right,
I've heard almost, I'd probably say 75% of the stories out of like 20 times, there was a pretty significant over-administration of Narcan.
That happens a lot.
Where somebody like bangs it in, like they'll hit the nasal spray and they're like, nothing happened. And they'll do another nasal spray, right on top of each other.
Yeah.
And, or someone's like, oh, that didn't work. And then they're just like, we're just going to keep doing it until it works.
Right.
So, and I haven't heard of any like ill effects from that yet, but I imagine that's probably one of those ones where it happens often is Narcan being used too much, but
there can be some longer term effects related to somebody in withdrawal. Because you got to think somebody that and anybody, the fact of the matter is you could be prescribed opioid pain medication and you don't have a substance use disorder. You just, you know, maybe you forgot, or maybe for whatever reason your medicine is administered via a pump or whatever, and the pump malfunctions. There's plenty of reasons without kind of having the idea of substance use disorders in the mix, why somebody might need Narcan. But if we dump a bunch of Narcan into somebody, the issue that we might run into is they may have some severe withdrawal.
Oh yeah.
And then we have to deal with that in another way, but it's difficult to deal with because you've flooded their body with this medication and it's blocking those opioid receptors.
Right.
So we can't even kind of give them a dose to kind of alleviate some of that withdrawal. But in general, it's a fairly safe medication to administer.
Yep.
But over-administration can be an issue if we're thinking long-term for somebody's withdrawal and that sort of thing.
It seems to be the only drug that they gave us a warning about where if once you administer this, they're going to hate you.
They're not going to be happy with you. You like, just ruined their high that they paid money for.
It's and it is not even just
or
that.
Stole,
it's
not or it's not somebody.
It's not even just that I want to dispel that a little bit because yeah, maybe some people feel that way, they're mad, but you have to think they've just had a period of apnea or not breathing.
Right.
And so they're hypoxic. And what happens when we become hypoxic? We oftentimes have an altered mental status. So I like to think and just believe in the good nature of people.
That oh, for sure.
It's not necessarily that they're mad at you. It's that that they're hypoxic. They're quite literally not able to critically think in this moment.
Yes.
Which is why they oftentimes are combative.
Right. Well, it's just like the idea that regardless of the motivations, it's sure. there is a high likelihood of some sort of behavioral repercussion that will come after you give somebody Narcan.
Yeah.
Like it's not all the time, but
be ready for it.
Yeah. So
the other aspect is you may administer Narcan because you're concerned about, you know, oh man, they're not breathing. But if you slam a bunch of Narcan, they may wake up combative, but then they also may vomit very, very shortly afterwards. And that is a potential for respiratory issues.
Yes.
Right. Some aspiration risk.
As a matter of fact, if you watch the first 10 minutes of Code 3, I know I'm like really pushing this movie. You might see a scene that has to deal with exactly that. Exactly that. But yeah, so naloxone is one of the ones that was, you know, it's just so ubiquitous now that it's like, of course we carry it or it's going to be available to us. And unfortunately, like it is so prevalent nowadays that it really needs to be like it is essential. in saving lives. Like
it is an unfortunate necessity.
Yeah. So those are the ones that as EMTs were on our list of we can administer them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Based off of offline protocols, meaning a doctor has decided that those things in these certain situations, you can make the decision without having to call them to say, hey, I would like to give them aspirin for chest pain of a suspected cardiac origin.
Right.
Like, okay, you can just do that. However, one thing to note, and I think it's important to kind of always know this, if you're ever unsure,
call,
right? Like that's the one thing they've told us, like, you know, you might be the guy who's calling the doctor a lot. Like but that's okay. Like mm-hmm. that's what they're there for. That's why there's medical command. That's why there is a medical director. Like, you know, if there's anything out of place that gives you that kind of like, oh, I have an unsured feeling of whether that happens, then just call because that's what they do. Like they're there to help answer those questions. And the same applies for the assisted medications too. And we chatted about these before.
We did.
Epinephrine is one of those ones, you know, for severe allergic reactions, auto injector, you know, it has to be theirs. That's the thing about the assisted administration is it has to be theirs. And they even went so far to say in class that you should really put it in their hand.
And you should assist.
And then you should assist their hand to do whatever it needs to happen. And that might be a little bit of an overstep a little aggressive. Like, okay, I get it. Will that happen every time? Maybe not. But, you know, still going through the process of like, I'm going to help you and I'm going to assist you in the most assistive way possible. Yes.
Right.
So that it's very clear that it's not you administering.
We're going to hold hands. It's going to be a tender moment.
Yep.
And we're going to put this stuff in you.
So epinephrine was that one. Bronchodilators, inhalers. What's that? Albuterol.
Albuterol.
Is like the most, you know, the one that I've heard of the most.
Yeah. Same.
So things for, which are typically prescribed for asthma or conditions where people get constrictive
histamine reaction,
like, you know, things where it makes people hard to breathe. Those help dilate the bronchi and helps people breathe. So again, you can help them with their dosage, but you can't get, like, you don't carry those drugs ready to go. Like but you can assist with theirs if they have it, which anybody I ever know that has an inhaler, when they need that inhaler, do you know where it is?
Not with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as we're talking about the assisted medications, right? So another aspect of the right time, is that medication in date?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's another aspect of the right time. And oftentimes you'll show up, and because a lot of these medications can, especially if we talk about EpiPens, they are super, super expensive. So you might not get one every year.
Right.
And you might try and just ride out having one that's a little bit expired. But us as EMS providers, we're put in a weird spot because it's like they've got it, but it's a little out of date. And now if it's way out of date, that's an issue in and of itself. But you know, what do you do? And if you're listening, first of all, follow your protocols. This is not medical advice, but a helpful thing you can do is to call your medical direction, because they may advise you to administer it anyway, but only after they have advised that. You gotta communicate what you have.
And what does that take? 20 seconds, 30 seconds of time? Mm-hmm. Like,
hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. But cover your ass. Like, that's the moral of the story. Like, you have somebody there that can give you cover. That is that their entire job and role at that moment is to make sure that you are doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Like, use it. Like, there's no reason not to. In my, like, granted, I'm the newbie, right? Like, I haven't been around this forever.
No, but you're right.
But that is what they exist for. Yeah, and if that leads to anything like not positive, then that's on them. Like, that's on the people around you, because that's what you should be using it for.
And the one instructor mentioned with that is, like, make sure you have a set of vitals to give the doctor when you make that phone call.
Yes.
Because if not, they're going to make you get a set of vitals. Yeah. So, like, make sure you have a baseline set of vitals so that you can give it to them so they can make the decision.
Like we talked about, I think, in the last episode with patient reports.
Yep.
Like, that's where it comes into play. You should be getting as much information about your patient as possible, what their current status is, what their demographic is. Be able to tell them, okay, like, they have this problem. I suspect this. Or maybe not suspect, but these are what I'm seeing. These are the vitals. And I've administered this, or I've done this intervention. And what was the outcome of it? Give them as much information as possible. And then that gives them the tools they need to make decisions.
In the instance of the EpiPen, though, if somebody's having a true anaphylactic emergency and you recognize that, and let's say the EpiPen's end date, I personally would not advise somebody to wait and get a set of vital signs. Well, let me get your blood pressure first.
Yeah.
But, you know, so because that is a life-saving medication.
Right.
But and you should definitely follow that up with vitals as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. But don't delay giving a life-saving medication for a set of vitals.
Yeah.
Especially if it's indicated.
So, you know, taking the EMT side out of it, and this is something we discussed, I think, probably in episodes one or two. There is going to be moments where I am tried, I think, in my morale, my ethics versus the professional obligations of being an EMT.
Right.
And I'm not necessarily saying I would not follow them, but I guarantee you that will be a moment that will test me. And I don't know whether or not I would be able to live with myself if, like, well, I know this is going to help, but I know I could get in trouble for it. Sometimes that is a decision that each individual has to make.
And you will come to that point in your career. I knew what that line was for me after several years of doing the job, and I won't tell anybody what that line is because you have to decide for yourself.
Sure, yeah.
But you have to come to that point where you decide, you know, was my certification worth losing? And sometimes the answer might be yes, but we're not advising you to go out of your practice.
This is not medical advice.
We're just telling you that there are going to be some tough decisions that have to be made.
It's the reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what real life is, right? Like, this is what, like, you as a person living with, or like working within a system, a structure, you're going to be confronted with things that you may or may not agree with. So you have to come to terms with that and figure out what your line in the sand is.
And decide whether this job's even right for you or not.
Well, yeah,
it's true.
Because you have to be professional about it.
Yeah.
All right. So last one in that list is, again, another one we talked about before. Nitroglycerin, the explosive, you know, heart-saving medication. Actually, it's not necessarily heart-saving, but it helps with pain. So it's indicated for chest pain of cardiac origin. It has contraindications. We talked about it. You can't give it if the patient has low blood pressure, if they're on those ED drugs. There are prescribed doses, like 0.4 milligram tablet or spray. You may repeat per the protocol. You may have to call medical command for, you know, the ability to give a second dose. Like, you just got to follow your protocols because it may be slightly different wherever you're at. But that's what you're going to get that guidance on when you should or shouldn't do these things.
Right.
Especially for an offline versus an online protocol. Online being something where if you're met with a certain situation that you're supposed to call based off of those parameters.
Right.
But yeah, so those are the assist drugs.
Yep.
And there were a couple of outliers from there too that like you can technically administer to yourself. In weird situations,
sure.
Atropine being, I don't even like, I've not gone through hazmat stuff where I understand where atropine would be necessarily the thing that you need, but in like biochemical or like mass casualty type incidents, you might run into something where you have to administer atropine to save your own life.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
And they specifically mention it in there as like, okay, atropine is one of those things that you may need to administer as part of your job to you. Activated charcoal seems a bit archaic almost.
I know it was something that was mentioned a lot, like when I was younger.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But
well, the idea of pumping stomach, activated charcoal. Those two things used to go hand in hand when people would talk about like overdoses.
Right.
Right. So, and the issue that I have seen through my career with activated charcoal, and it's like, we don't even carry it anymore.
Yeah. And we don't hear either.
Yeah. Oftentimes it will, you know, cause GI upset. Mm-hmm. And now you've got somebody vomiting all over the place. And I look, if I had to have a thing that I don't like, it's not, it's vomit. I don't like it.
You don't like it, weirdo.
I mean, everybody, listen, and you guys will discover this. Everybody's got their thing that they don't like, and mine just happens to be vomit. So I'm going to do whatever I can to avoid my patients vomiting all over the place. You want some Zofran? Here you go, man. So, but anyway, it is still one of those nationally registered taught drugs. It's still in a lot of drug boxes across the country. Less so now, I would say, but, it's just not one that it was on its way out 15 years ago in our area. They were just like, yeah, you're not going to use it, but you got to know it. And it still seems like it's that way, but some people still swear by it.
It's so funny because everybody seems to talk about it the same way.
Yes.
The class talked about it the same way. My service talked about it the same way in terms of like, oh yeah, we used to have those, but nobody uses them. Like it's just, it's fallen out of favor. It's not necessarily part of the protocols in our service, or I don't even think it's actually in the state of Pennsylvania, something that is under the protocols anymore.
I think one instructor,
but it's still on the national EMT.
It's on the national registry. Yeah.
One of the instructors mentioned like rural areas that you may see it there.
Perhaps based off of the medical director in that area might authorize it. Cause if they have delayed care, it may be something that is beneficial, but nowadays, everyone's got such easy access to advanced medical care. It's get them there, and I'm sure they'll take care of what needs to get taken care of when it comes to stomach contents. But yeah, so a lot of things that we can do as EMTs that we will have the ability to help administer or administer interventions, just like the other things that we can do. So I thought the pharma stuff was really interesting, especially knowing the rules around it. It's a pretty limited set. And then like, I think it's also good to kind of mention and to recognize that like, okay, I think that was six things that we can administer offline, right? It's help me count here. We got aspirin, oral glucose, oxygen, naloxone. Four offline medications. Whole things. How many can you do, Jonathan, as a paramedic generally?
We need an immediate count.
And here's the thing. There are drugs that they work in different ways in the body, but we get a similar result.
Sure, yeah.
For them. And so there's multiple drugs that may be used for the same condition.
Exactly.
Man, it's a lot. it's a lot.
Well, is it 50?
Yeah, I mean, like, it all depends on your service,
man. Sure, yeah.
Like, just, again, so at work, on my travel contract, I have access to drugs that I don't have access to here locally in my 911 system.
Sure, yeah.
So, I would say 50 is a good number to kind of get an idea of the just drugs you have to be aware of, but you're probably not going to carry all 50 potential medications.
Yeah, right?
Your service will probably pick one or the other, or maybe they'll have both, but a lot of times cost is an issue as well.
Sure.
So it's like, yeah.
But yeah, it's just to say that like with greater knowledge and education, there is a higher level of, you know, expectation at knowing the different drugs and things that are available, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, but it's just a testament to how far you can go in this career to say, hey, look, there's steps that you can keep going to have a greater scope of practice. right. more abilities to use, more tools that you can use, more interventions that you can use. Like that's, it's more just along the lines of like, man, the more I get into being an EMT, the more respect I have for paramedics.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like really?
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, yeah. Damn, like there is a lot.
800 hours.
Yeah. So, there's some other concepts that we went over for, you know, drug stuff, but really the important things were knowing those drugs, knowing the interventions, and just making sure that we're paying attention to those and following our protocols. The last thing that they really mentioned was like, all of this has to go hand in hand with monitoring.
Yeah.
Reassessment. Yeah. Like all of this comes from an assessment. And then it all has to be reinforced and rechecked through assessment.
Right. Make sure whatever you administer is working.
Yeah.
Right. 100%.
And then you're always constantly in that loop of mm-hmm. making sure, like, what did I do? What can I do next? Yep. Is it working? What can I do? What can I do? You know, just making sure that you're constantly assessing.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then, and documenting. That's a big one too.
Oh yeah.
100%.
You have to write it down. You have to make sure you're tracking all the medications that you give. And if you don't track it, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it's your ass.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
it is indeed.
Ultimately, it's your butt.
So we have, we learned a lot about pharmaceuticals, and there was actually an unexpected tool that we heard about that night. So with that, we're kind of through the notes of the class, and we can talk about that tool in Max's tool of the trade.
Yeah. So during class, the instructor talked about this thing called mobile PDR. And when he said it, I was like, oh, that's cool. And then we looked at it, and it was an amazing, amazing, amazing app for your phone. What I didn't do was I did not connect the initials of it to what it was, which was just a mobile version of the physician's desk reference.
So what is the physician's desk reference?
So it was created primarily to serve as a comprehensive drug information resource for healthcare professionals, especially physicians, pharmacists, and nurses. Here's the breakdown of its primary purpose: provide official drug information that's been filed with the FDA,
mm-hmm.
Ensure safe and informed prescribing. So does it have any interaction issues? What's the dosage? Mm-hmm. Serve as a quick clinical reference. Like, what is this person taking this drug for if you're looking over their own prescriptions? Like, what are the uses for this drug?
It's, in essence, a drug encyclopedia.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
On your phone.
So the book, which I own one, is I think 3.5 inches thick.
It's big.
It's huge. So what they did was they turned that into an app for your phone. So
makes perfect sense.
Bit of background to it. So the first time it was launched, it was in 2005. It was mainly meant for PDAs, basically any kind of electronic device that hospitals were
using.
Physical
displays of affection?
Oh, look at you.
public displays of affection.
Yes, that's what it is. But so that instead of carrying around this book that weighs 10 pounds, they have a reference that's electronic. In 2015, it was modified for cell phones. And that was when it was launched as an actual separate independent app.
And it looks like that's about the last time somebody designed that app.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I can't imagine why he's critiquing the design of said app.
It's okay. Almost like I am very forgiving for the design of things. If it works really well, this one works well enough.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So unique features. Every single time you research a drug, it stores that in the menu. So like it's a list that you have in that app in your phone saying, okay, you looked at this particular drug.
It's got a recent list.
So you have a quick reference that way. You can either look at the brand, generic, or pharmacological name of the drug. So any one of those three, you're able to research and get the same information. It's cross-referenced. You can also look at comparisons to other drugs. So are there other drugs that maybe are named different or have a different generic name that do the same thing? Interactions, I think that's the big thing. Is there going to be a negative interaction between two different doses, two different medications? And also, you can even look up the description. You can put in the description of the pill, the color, the ID number on the pill.
Mm-hmm.
That way, if all you are handed is a bag of weekly organizers of pills, you can start mm-hmm. figuring out what it is you're dealing with.
And I think it's the reason why I think this immediately resonated with us as a tool is because they've been very good at emphasizing to us that we're not just, you know, we're not just taxi drivers. We're not just
right.
EMTs, you know, and this is my understanding of this has evolved too. Cause like when I first got into EMT, you know, thinking about going into EMT school, I was like, oh, it seems like a pretty simplistic job and we're not going to be able to do anything. And that has completely been erased. And really just the idea that we are early intervention and probably more so the intervention side, the fact finding side, mm-hmm. like
right.
the assessment side is really the superpower of the EMT, right? Like you can find out as much information as you can early on scene as a professional, getting in, checking all those medications, knowing what to look for, yeah. knowing all the things to help guide medical treatment. That's, I think, really the unsung aspect of EMTs is yeah, like you are the best fact finder on scene.
We're the physical eyes for the physicians that are going to deal with the emergency once they receive it.
Exactly.
And I know from personal experience seeing a bag of just weekly organizers that are full of pills and they all look the same. They all look the same. So just the ability to do it by description alone was pretty friggin' amazing.
Description's good. I mean, most people will have them in their little tubes, but you can then look those things up in the app, and then that can help track them. Most of the time, I think people are going to be writing down the list and the dosages, but actually, from my experience, most of the patients that I've gone to that are in that kind of polypharmacy environment where they have like the big bag of pills, they usually have a printout next to that bag of pills because they do this a lot.
Yeah.
Like you've been lucky, Mike.
I know. I've been lucky, but I also find that I'm like, oh, okay, this is a thing. Like people do this a lot.
Next Friday, gallon Ziploc of just pills dumped in a bag.
It may be the case, but I mean, that's an extreme that I don't think we're going there and we're sifting through this thing. At that point, you have to prioritize patient treatment and transport versus, oh, let me pick through each one of these pills to figure them all out. Like, you know, I'll just bring it to the hospital and say, hey, they handed me this. Like, like I just needed to make sure they got here safely and that, you know, that respiratory issue that they were having was taken care of.
I could so see like an annoying rookie and they're like, hey, rookie. That desk right there with that chair, here you go.
I need you to try each one of those pills. Tell me what it does.
Tell me how you're feeling.
Describe the flavor.
Yeah.
But an amazing tool. An amazing tool.
It's great. The physician's desk reference, I had one on my desk like 15 years ago, and it was just this big hulking like ring binder thing that sits there.
Yeah.
I had a hardcover version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you could kill someone with that thing.
But, you know, it's an encyclopedia. You don't need to read the whole thing cover to cover. But when you need information on a very particular drug, it's great. Yep. Like, and they made it. They made it exactly for what it needs to be.
Which is awesome.
Now, one little tip.
Yes.
About the app.
Yes.
One of my gripes. If you have a modern phone, like an iPhone, and it's in dark mode, every phone comes in default dark mode nowadays, by the way. You will not be able to read the text in the app because they have not updated their styling of the app.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Even though phones have progressed to the point where they have darker backgrounds as a default, for some reason they have not fixed the coding. So if anybody from the PDR app team is listening, please update your freaking code to be responsive to dark mode. If you want to use the app, you have to physically turn dark mode off on your phone, which is a system setting. So you have to change dark mode off for the entire phone and then turn it back on afterwards. So,
yep.
I know this is getting real deep in the weeds, but when we opened it in class,
was unreadable.
Can't read it. So I figured out how to actually use it. You have to turn off dark mode on your phone.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the tool of the trade for this week is the mobile PDR. It's good. It's really like those are the little ones that were like, yes, we had no idea that existed. And that's a good one to have.
And I mean, the minute we heard it was like, oh yeah, this is 100% going to be next week's.
So yeah. And that brings us to obviously everybody's favorite.
I mean, it's why they've been sitting here.
It's why we put it last in the podcast. Cause we're like, oh, man, we can't put Jonathan first. And then they'll just turn off the podcast after he like gives them everything they want.
5 minutes later. So we've got a student tip of the week, or for the episode. So we're talking about administering medications, and I want to emphasize a process or a methodology that could be helpful to you, making sure you are able to follow the five rights for your patients as you're administering medications. It, as I learned it, it was called a medication triple check. And so what you will do is you will take the medication that you are going to administer to the patient after you've confirmed your five rights, and you will, as an extra added layer, reconfirm that this is actually the medication that you want to administer. And you might say, well, why are we kind of repeating this process? You know, haven't we already done this? But at 3 a.m, when you've been woken up and you're going to answer this call, you want to make sure that that you've got a process to deal with this. So your medication triple check is going to be, I'm going to pick the medication up, I'm going to look at it, I'm going to read the medication and the dose that I'm about to administer to the patient. I'm going to say all of that out loud. My partner, I'm going to show him or her the medication. They're going to read the medication and the dosage out loud. And then again, I'm going to come back to myself and I'm going to read and say the dosage of the medication out loud. And then I'm going to say the time in which I administered it. And that is the medication triple check. This just ensures that, again, we administer the correct medication to the correct patient with the correct dosage. So double checking some of those five rights in that process. But that is the student tip of the episode.
I love it. So it's over the top, and it borders on almost overly aggressive when it comes to communication, but that's exactly what you need to do. Like, mm-hmm. you know, to, like you said, for that instance, you need to do it that way every time, because there's going to be the 3 a.m. call where you're groggy and the lights are dark and right. you're trying to do a million things on the ambulance, and that will help, you know, make sure that you're eliminating errors.
That's the whole purpose behind it. You know, these things get developed because mistakes are made, and these are ways to alleviate making some of those mistakes. Yeah. So hopefully it's beneficial. Hopefully if your service isn't already doing something like this, you as a student or you when you become an EMT are able to, at least for your own personal benefit, do this.
Yep. Yep. Cool. I like it. All right, so that brings us to the close of I Don't Try Drugs, But the Drugs Try Me, our pharmacologic block for this school year, I guess. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm saying. But we're at the end of the episode. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll join us next time on the Ride Along. Where's the button?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm missing the button.
Oh, no.
There it is. Bye, everybody. This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing it over.